Justice Thomas received 103 gifts with a total value of more than $2.4 million.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas officially disclosing that trips he took were paid for by a GOP mega donor,
including to this lakeside resort, taking private jet rides, and island hopping in Indonesia on this super yacht.
Thomas said he inadvertently omitted them from financial disclosure forms as required by law.
But this conduct is just so outrageous. The amounts of money involved, the failure to disclose, it's off the charts bad. I do think if I were an attorney general of the United States, I'd start an investigation of Justice Thomas, because I think there's enough there to warrant criminal investigation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me every week, and we are here again. George, how you going? What's up, man? Where are you?
I am in Ventnor City, New Jersey,
okay.
And we're going to talk about the law of pickleball today.
Is that a pickleball court back there?
Well, there's tennis courts, and then they turned half of them into pickleball courts because, you know, pickleball.
Are you into pickleball?
No. But, it looks like it's fun. I should try it. Looks like it's more fun than tennis, actually.
I have a plan to get into pickleball soon.
It looks like good exercise, you know, kind of like squash, except it's outdoors and whatnot. I don't know.
Okay. Well, we'll see if we can see anyone playing behind you. I know you're kind of in...
I can just walk around and show you. I will just do the podcast. I'll just walk around. I'll go show you the beach. You know,
maybe later. I do think...
I don't wear my perfect jeans on the beach.
Okay, hold on. We're not even in the perfect jeans yet. Hold on.
They may be perfect for that.
I know you're in vacation mode, so I appreciate you coming in to do this. So here's what we're going to do. Nice, loose, but tight show here, okay?
Right.
So,
Like we
normally do. Trump met with his probation officer this week for his pre-sentence interview.
I would have paid money to go to that. I would have, traded Super Bowl tickets to sit in on that one.
So what this is like, this is, so I don't know what a pre-sentencing interview is. This is how they decide what his sentence might be in July?
I mean, what it is is that the court considers the sentencing memos submitted by the parties and also any observations about the defendant and his ability to be rehabilitated and his remorse or lack of remorse and other factors that the judge might find relevant. The probation officer is supposed to give a report to aid the judge. And this happens in federal court as well, except the federal court, I think they actually make sentence recommendations, the probation officer. In the state courts, they don't, as I understand it. So things like, he's not remorseful. If he's a multiple offender and had a prior criminal history, that might be relevant. For him, we know who he is. And there probably wasn't that much for the probation officer to do other than just ask a standard set of questions. But it would have been fun to watch.
Do you think Trump was just hostile and terrible?
It depends on his mood, right? I don't think he was, I'm sure he was not happy or pleased. And I'm sure that the steam was coming out of the back of his head, but you know, sometimes he can hold it together and be composed for 20 or 30 minutes at a time and he's going to be the same old Trump no matter where he is. He just may be on or off. More or less crazy, depending on the hour. That's just the way he is.
So let me ask you something. It sort of begs the question. Just thinking about it, Trump loves to be aggrieved, right? And so
narcissists always love to be aggrieved. It's part of their thing.
So does he want a little jail time so he can rail?
No,
about
he doesn't.
No.
I mean, here's where we're playing amateur, untrained psychoanalyst here. He does not actually want to go to jail, but he loves to complain about things. And so it's not that he necessarily loves the things that he complains about, but he'll complain about anything whenever he gets the chance. And he does love to complain. He does not want to go to jail. He's terrified of it. And that's why he's freaking out. That's why he apparently called up Speaker Johnson yelling profanities and saying we need to fix this conviction, and so he wants the House of Representatives to pass some sort of law to, you know, help him out, and I'm not sure what that legislation would look like and whether it could possibly ever be passed, but he's not happy.
He did. It was like an expletive-laden phone call to what is supposedly the very pious Mike Johnson demanding.
No,
that
it's okay.
House
it. The use of the F word is okay as long as it's, you know, with as long as it's you know, doesn't involve adultery. Oh wait, never mind.
You know, this is not really, it's not super relevant, but it is amazing to me that, and this is true of back when the day, so I'm just going to, I'll do a little, tell you guys a little story here. But back in the day when I was a young, just coming out, young Republican, right? Young lesbian Republican. And I had to be on Rick Santorum's book tour because I worked for a think tank that published Rick Santorum's book, It Takes a Family. And so I was on tour with Rick Santorum while he just like talked about how gay people shouldn't get married and how it's like 2005.
Did he know that you were gay?
No, I barely knew. I was just sort of getting around to it. And, I remember a time when one of the things I remember about him was that like he seemed like he really believed it, right? That it was his, he talked about his faith a lot. And I remember a conservative movement that was, where so many people talked about their faith, and I sort of like took them at face value back then, that they genuinely believed these things. And right, this was post Bill Clinton. And yep. So I came of age in a Republican Party that talked a lot about sexual morality.
Right.
And it, what was crazy to me about Trump was the extent to which an entire movement that had built itself around sexual morality and anti-gay marriage and this was like totally cool with the three-time adulterer, like cheat on everybody, porn star, hush money, all this stuff. And Mike Johnson, who seems to like represent that flavor, and Mike Pence too, right? These guys all just got on board. And it will never cease to amaze me how little any of them meant it.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. That's one of the many things that has stunned me about the last 7 or 8 years. I did think they mostly believed it, but I could never, and that's why I couldn't conceive of them. The fact that we are still dealing with this guy today, I thought at some point they'd just say, basta, enough, I can't deal with this. And apparently they just forgive anything for him. I mean, he really could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and you know, they'll graft an exception onto the commandment that says thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill, except if you're Donald Trump on Fifth Avenue and there's a lip at the end of the gun. I mean, I you know, it's
okay. All right. Back to the legal news. Okay. So on Wednesday, the prosecutors in the Georgia election interference case filed a motion to dismiss the pending appeal on the question of Fani Willis's disqualification. Is there any chance that that appeal gets dismissed?
I really don't know. I mean, I have to say, I read the brief and I thought it was very effective. I thought it very effectively made the point that if you take the factual findings of the judge, there's just no basis for recusal. And all there is are, you know, it's all fact driven, whether or not the defendants were adversely affected and whether or not there was a conflict of interest. It really depends on the facts. And the judge found facts that basically where there's no, that there was no conflict, that Fani Willis did not have an incentive to bring the case because of her relationship with that fellow, and that in any event, that the defendants weren't prejudiced, and so there's no basis for actually recusing her. And I think as a matter of law, that's correct. And in terms of what you do in appellate court, and typically in appellate courts, almost always in appellate courts, the appellate courts have to accept the findings of fact of the lower court, unless they are clearly erroneous. And this judge held an overlong hearing. I don't see how you could find his factual determinations, including his finding that what's the name of the guy again?
The
prosecutor who did have to leave the case, that his ex-law partner. Had lacked credibility because the ex-law partner had been making allegations about, oh, the relationship with Fani started much sooner than Fani and her lover said it did. And, you know, on the basis of that, there's really no, the appeal should be dismissed. The appeal should never have been granted because it's a discretionary appeal. That said, it's hard for me to see a court of appeals saying, oh, we're granting review, and then say, oh, never mind. Although it was pointed out to me this morning by a Georgia law professor. He says that the panel that granted the appeal is different from the panel that will actually hear the case. So the panel that actually hears the case may just decide, oh, yeah, we've read this. This is BS, and we're going to toss the case. I think what they're doing here, I think it's unlikely to succeed is my best guess. And in fact, the Professor Kreiss, I was tweeting with him on this today, says that he's not sure that under Georgia law there's a procedure for a party to make a motion to sua sponte, make a motion to have the court dismiss an appeal as improvidently granted, although the court can sua sponte do that and do it on its own motion. So I think what this is just it's a long shot bid to see if they could short circuit the appeal and get a few months back from this appeal while it's delaying the case, and so they're hoping that if we can short circuit this, and we'll get the time back, and we can start bringing the case sooner. Although it's not going to be, I doubt it's going to be brought before the election.
Yeah, it's that to me is like the real, misjudgment here from Fani Willis, is that it basically turned this, what was a pretty, they've got Trump on tape saying find the votes. And, this would have been a good case to, I think, emphasize what Trump was doing around the election. And instead, it's all about Fani Willis, and it's all.
Yeah, I think the two issues with what happened are, one was the judgment in having the relationship, and then when the relationship was discovered, they should have just said, sorry, it didn't affect the case, but he's leaving. And that I think would have fixed the problem almost immediately. There wouldn't be this hearing. There wouldn't be this appeal, I think. I mean, they would have made a motion, but it would have been harder to win. I just think there would have been a lot less to it. I think by being a stick in the mud, she made it worse for herself. The other thing I think that's an important factor here as to why this case isn't going to be tried is they went broad. And, part of me liked that because it shows the broad conspiracy. They charged dozens of defendants, and they put a whole boatload of counts. I mean, I forget how many, several dozen. And I like the RICO aspect of it to some extent. The problem is it takes longer. Too many defendants, too much discovery, too much motion practice. And, there is something to be said for Jack Smith's approach, which was to just bring one case against one defendant with one set of charges. There is that immunity issue that's holding that one up. So,
yeah, we'll get to the immunity there. We did get one Supreme Court judgment today on one of the big cases, which was the
Mifepristone.
Mifepristone. Yeah, I can never quite
pronounce
that.
Did I say that right? Mifepristone? I say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, but it's the basically access to birth control ruled
no standing
correctly, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. There was no standing for these people. That was pretty clear from the beginning.
Okay, so before we get to the immunity, though, I want to talk quickly about Hunter Biden and his conviction this week.
I don't care about the convictions of anybody who's not running for president. I'm focused on focused on the president.
Is
Hunter Biden running for president?
He is not.
I would not vote. I'm not voting for Hunter Biden.
I also am not going to vote for Hunter Biden. Can I ask you though on, they took 3 hours. They came back. They rendered a verdict. He's guilty, and it sounds like it was pretty straightforward that he was going to be found guilty. He was, in fact, using drugs at the time that he had this gun, which is illegal.
It was illegal, but also he filled out a form saying that he was not an addict.
So he lied
at the time. So he lied, and that was part of the whole shebang.
I guess the question I have is, like, the Republican response to this has been very interesting from this is just a sweetheart deal, right, for Hunter to distract from the Biden crime family's thing.
there's no sense to any of it. In fact, last year on MSNBC, one Friday night, I decided to take a chance and do something crazy on Alex Wagner's show. And I drew this handwritten chart because it was, I think, July or August of 2023. There was all this upset among the Republicans that a special counsel was not appointed for the Biden case. And so, I mean, I made this flowchart that basically shows that, okay, that you, if there's a special counsel appointed, you say the special counsel is terrible. It should have been Rudy Giuliani. If the special counsel is not appointed, oh, you should have kept, you know, basically whatever happens, they're going to find a way to criticize it and make something up about it. So any, if he had been acquitted, the fix would have been in. If he's convicted, these charges were make weight, or again, this conspiracy theory, this is just an attempt to distract from something, I don't know. And they just say anything. They'll just pull, you know, it's almost like they have random answers that they pull out of a hat, and they'll just scream at the top of their lungs. And it doesn't have to make any sense, but to people watching on Fox News, it makes them outraged. So
it does make, it's true. You know, we did a focus group with two-time Trump voters from Utah, not Mormons in particular, but just Utah two-time Trump voters right
after. Utahns.
And they were like, boy, with our crooked justice system, Hunter must have been really guilty for them to do this. Or they did this thing about, like, this is just a distraction. You know, they're getting Hunter on something small so that they can pretend like they're, you know, pursuing something and they're missing all the big stuff that includes Biden. So those talking points are filtering down a pace.
Yeah, and they're not consistent. They contradict one another, but no one, you know, they don't use logic. It's all about just the outrage of the moment, and nobody pays attention to the facts anymore, and nobody pays attention to reason, and nobody tries to be consistent anymore. That's the hallmark of republicanism and conservatism. I don't even call it conservatism. It's what passes for conservatism today, is just you don't use reason, you don't use logic, you don't use facts, you just scream whatever it is you think is out, you can convince people is outrageous at a given moment and spin them up, and then run from there. I mean, that's what this is all about, and it makes no sense. And meanwhile, you've got this guy who's been convicted on 34 counts by an actual jury in an actual court, and he's, you know, subject to 54 more counts in three other courts of criminal conduct, felonies, and, you know, we don't care about that.
Right. And that guy, the one you're talking about, is actually running for president.
Yes, and he is running for president. Yeah. I'm not going to vote for Hunter Biden. I'm not going to vote for the other guy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to vote for him either.
Same. Okay.
Not hard. Don't vote for the criminal.
Okay. George.
Yes,
ma'am. Supreme Court. There continues to be a lot of drama at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, no, everybody was like hyped up, and you're going to see this every day. They have decisions that are going to be issued. Like, I don't know what the decision schedule is, but usually it's Mondays, Tuesdays, and or Thursdays, and sometimes Wednesdays. They announce them in advance, and everybody was hyped up for today. I'm convinced that the cases that people are most interested in, which are the January 6th immunity case, and then the January 6th related case involving the interpretation of the obstruction statute, I'm convinced those are going to come at the very end, particularly the immunity case. And I still am hopeful that a good result will occur. I don't think you can necessarily assume from the argument that it's going to be a disaster. I could be wrong. But I think, you know, I think what's going to happen is this case is going to get back on track one way or the other. So we'll see. I could be wrong. I'll maybe be eating those words, and we'll see.
Well, let me throw some game theory about this at you. It seems to me, with all the, like, the flag upside down and the secret recordings of Alito and Thomas, and then the stuff it was Alito and Roberts that were both caught on tape, and then it was Thomas. It's got all these ethics things coming out. Like, it seems like if Roberts had a decision where they were saying absolutely no immunity, that they'd want to get it out fast and, like, get some of this stuff. No?
Is that sure, you know, in a perfect world, he would like that, perhaps. But you can't control that with nine people who don't necessarily submit well to being told what to do. I mean, they are completely all independent actors in a way, in a important way. They vote the way they want to vote. They can write whatever opinion each of them wants to write. They can join whatever opinion each of them wants to join. And, you know, they can make things complicated for themselves by addressing things that don't have to be addressed, or by taking a different approach or looking at things a different way. And they may disagree on particular nuances that might not matter, that I might not be able to explain even if you gave me 2 hours on a podcast. You just don't know. I mean, this was a very important case, and one that everyone was very focused on. And, you could end up with the delay is just something that results from having basically, as somebody has once put it, it's basically you have 9 separate law firms operating in the same building. And it's just like, sometimes it's like herding cats. So I can't, the ability of the Chief Justice to do that is limited. Warren did a pretty good job of it. Berger, less so. Rehnquist did an okay job of it. But you just can't. It really depends on the case and on the personalities on the court.
So just on the timing, like the actual calendar, you just said, so today's Thursday when we're taping. So today we got some decisions. So you're saying, though, that you think the Tuesday the 18th?
No. And I have to look at the decision schedule. I think this case is going to come out, the immunity case, on the week of the 24th, because that's the last week.
Last week. Wow.
It's going to be like, it could be like the day, it could be on the 26th or the 27th. It could be when you and I will be out in Aspen and doing different panels, and there'll be that debate. I mean, it's going to be a wild end of the month.
That is true.
My bet would be that week, week of the 24th. I have to take a look and see what decision days they have scheduled, but they often add decision days at the end when they've figured out which ones are going to be ready on which day, or what they can target on given days. And what happens with this court is that the work backs up. And that's why you just see, basically, you'll see 20 cases come down in the last couple of weeks at least. And this Supreme Court operates. It's not like some other courts that are in session on and off throughout the year, even in the summers. I mean, like, for example, the New York Court of Appeals has this rule where they get every single decision out in 4 weeks between sittings. There's something to be said about that, but some cases are just harder. And the Supreme Court has always had this system since as long as I can remember. I don't know what they did back in the days before they had word processing, but they go away in June, and a lot of the decisions come down in June, because that's when they got to go, and that's just the way they are.
Well, the good news for our listeners is, you're right, we will be in Aspen together, and so if the decision does come down that week, we'll probably be able to get an emergency pod together.
Yes, in a gondola, probably. overlooking a beautiful town.
Yeah, bring your travel mic. Listen, I do want to ask you, though, I've been really curious to ask you with the Alito stuff when this recording came out.
Yeah.
I'm not wild about these recording type things, because especially one of the things about the way that this was done is she was saying things that he was agreeing with. And so it wasn't that he said some of this stuff, right? I think this probably happens to you, right? When you do things where a lot of people are coming up and talking to you, you are often being polite. So you may sort of agree with some things just to be like, yes, thank you for your comments and for showing up, and sure. I do, though, it does, however, feel consistent, like the difference between what Roberts did and what Alito said, as they were both being really highlighted.
Yeah.
I think the difference in their temperaments. But what did you make of
Yeah, that's exactly Alito's what report? I agree with everything you just said. I'm not particularly excited about people walking around with recording devices, and even in public places, without announcing them. But that said, the product is very, very interesting. And as you say, the differences between Alito's responses and Roberts's responses are quite telling. And I have to say this, as someone who has become a public figure over the last few years, I think that if you're a judge, you don't bite on any of this stuff. You don't talk about politics. It's just a bad idea. And the other thing about it is, which goes generally to all of us, is I don't say anything at a cocktail party that I wouldn't say on this podcast or on national television. Okay. And frankly, because I've reached a stage in life where I don't give an F about a lot of stuff, that's 99%. I don't bite my tongue on very much in any venue. In fact, the only difference is I'll use more F-bombs at a cocktail party than I will on this podcast and none on TV. So, I think that's just the way to go through life. But as a judge, you have to keep your mouth shut. And you have to keep your mouth shut. When people want to talk about politics, you just sort of demur and just say, well, I'm not going to really talk about that. And if they want to talk about, how their judging affects the politics, I think Roberts' approach there was just absolutely right. Look, we're always in the middle of controversy. This is what happens, and that's life. And it's not my job to fix all the political problems. We don't do politics. We do law. And that's the right answer. And that's the way a judge should look at it. And that should be the answer that all nine of them should give. And that should be the truth. And, I have a limited amount of sympathy, even though I don't necessarily like the idea of people walking around recording other people surreptitiously, except in extreme circumstances. What I find most unfathomable about this recording, these recordings, both of Alito's, frankly, is that it occurred like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, after the whole controversies about those flags came up. And at that point, you would think common sense would say, just don't get in a conversation with anybody about any of this or anything that could be construed as relating to it. Because look, that should be the rule generally. And it's tough. It's a tough rule. OK, we like to talk. Judges are smart people. They like to talk. They're often very interested in politics. They like to talk about politics. But there are two basic rules. When you become a judge, you can't talk about politics the way you used to, particularly in places where there are people who you don't know very well, if at all. And, it's one thing to talk about it with your cousin, like, oh, who do you think's going to win this primary or whatever. They do that. And that's fine. And the other rule is, if you don't have the money for a $250,000 recreational vehicle, okay, and you want to have that money, and your salary isn't enough for it, resign from the bench and go join a law firm. Okay, so those are kind of the rules that should be played here. You have to. There are sacrifices that you make when you put on those robes, and one of them is you have to keep your mouth shut, and you have to be guarded in what you say publicly. I'm not sure I like all the speechifying that all the justices do from time to time. And not just the conservative ones. You have to accept the fact that you're going to get shitty pay. And, that's sort of the moral of these most recent controversies is that, you join the bench, you join the judgeship, you join the judiciary. Well, you got to play by a different set of rules in terms of your personal and personal conduct. And this has all been very, very disappointing, and it's very damaging to the court.
You brought up the Thomas thing. Like, I just it was
the
just
Thomas
reported.
Thing is way, way, way worse.
Well, hold on. Let me just say this. The Justice Thomas received 103 gifts with a total value of more than $2.4 million between 2004 and 2023. The next closest justice was Alito, who received 16 gifts worth $170,000. So Thomas, blows the other people out of the water. How non-traditional is it? Like contextualize this for me, what Thomas is doing.
Contextualize it. It's just a huge sum of money. And the issue also is a lot of that was not disclosed in the first instance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back in time to Abe Fortas, who was a justice of the Supreme Court appointed by Lyndon Johnson. At one point, he was going to be nominated to be Chief Justice by Johnson. But at the end, I think that his nomination was shot down because he had accepted speaking engagement money or something, or some kind of stipend from a guy who was being investigated by the SEC, whose case wasn't even before the Supreme Court. And, some foundation of some rich guy in New York. And the amount of money, even if you adjusted for inflation, wasn't all that much. I think it's probably not more than the $170,000 that Alito took. It would have been low on this totem pole here. So, I mean, so what happened with Fortas was the Justice Department, the Nixon Justice Department, Nixon being Nixon and John Mitchell being John Mitchell, they said, hey, we can get this guy to resign and get a seat for ourselves on the Supreme Court. And that's what they did. They basically went to Earl Warren and said, we're going to prosecute Fortas, and it's going to make the court look really bad if you don't get him to resign. And Fortas resigned for the benefit of the good of the court. He must be rolling in his grave if he's, you know, if his spirit is watching the current festivities with Thomas.
Can you explain to me what the, like, there's no ramifications. There's nothing, like, nothing anybody can do. I mean, Biden's not going to go, or could he? It's just wild to me. And actually, let me ask it a different way. Do you think that any of the stuff that Alito has done or that Thomas is doing warrants recusal and or recrimination? Like, is there something that you think should be done about this, or what could be done?
I mean, I read a nice open letter today by in the Bulwark, in fact.
Oh, that's a good publication.
Yeah, I recommend it. Do you subscribe?
I do subscribe.
Right. No, and it was written by a guy named Philip Allen Lacavara, who is a longtime Supreme Court advocate, and he's, you know, I think he's a liberal, but he's not a crazy liberal. And he wrote this very, very cogent letter to Alito, public letter to Alito, that was published in The Bulwark, saying, look, you should reconsider this. And these are the reasons why you should recuse yourself, because this is, you know, this conduct is really, you know, the standard under 28 U.S.C. 455, I think the statute is it basically says if a judge or justice shall recuse himself, as uses mandatory language, if his or her impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And I, you know, after all this, it's hard to imagine that, you know, I do think it's when people question his impartiality, I think it's a reasonable thing for these people to do. So I think the standard for recusal has been met. In terms of Thomas, the recusal aspect is a little, I think the case is a little less strong because these, you know, it's not clear you don't have his house having the flag, and you don't have his remarks being taped. I think that Ginny Thomas's conduct was, you know, not only wrong from a patriotic standpoint of view or what her sentiments were, but I think it does not help her husband do her job. I think the recusal question there, I can see people arguing differently, but I don't think he necessarily has to recuse there. I do think if I were an attorney general of the United States, and I would like to think I'd have the gumption, I'd start an investigation of Justice Thomas, because I think there's enough there to warrant criminal investigation. And if I were a member of Congress, I would welcome an investigation at a congressional level. And I say that with, I don't like the idea of investigating Supreme Court justices. I think it does potentially infringe on the independence of the court, but this conduct is just so outrageous, so beyond the pale, the amounts of money involved, the failure to disclose, it's off the charts bad. And I don't care who the justice is. I don't care if I agree with their jurisprudence, and I agree a lot with Thomas in ways that would make liberals head spin. I don't care if it's Sotomayor. I don't care if it's Kagan. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's the Chief Justice. I don't care if anybody doing this stuff. It's outrageous, and it's terrible for the court. And I would love to see Justice Thomas resign tomorrow because of this, and show and admit fault, and do something for the court and for the country. But, you know, I don't see that happening.
Your point that you made a little bit ago about, like, the Alito's getting recorded just a week or so after, like, this
crazy
major controversy. And it's this point about they don't care about the court's perception. Like, to do this job, what you care about is that people believe that the court has some impartiality, right? That they're upholding the law, that they don't. And so, like, look, and I've seen other people fail to do this at times. Like, I remember when Justice Ginsburg said something about Trump, like how it would be insane if he won or something like that. And she ended up coming out and apologizing for that because it was the wrong thing to do.
Correct.
But so, like, what's crazy to me about Alito is that, like, all of
although
this
happens. She was right. I mean, but
on the merits, but like the same point, right?
But she was right to apologize too.
And she was right to apologize.
For a justice should say. Absolutely.
And so what's amazing here is that after all of this, Alito seems entirely unconcerned. Like if you're
there's this incredible narcissism involved where people think they are more important than institutions. And, you know,
That's it. That they don't care about maintaining
they care about themselves. Like it's me. I'm entitled to this. I've been put upon. I mean, this is, I think, a Thomas-like attitude. Poor me. I don't have enough pay. So I deserve all of this. And then you have Mrs. Alito, who's basically saying, I'm going to sue, I'm this, I'm that, I'm da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And there's unless the allegations are completely 100% false, which is inconsistent with what we saw in terms of the flag and the chronology. I mean, she should be remorseful and apologetic.
Yeah.
And instead she's like, I'm going to sue these people. I'm going to be, and she's saying, I'm of German descent and we Germans fight back or something like that, which is crazy. You know, Frau Alito. I mean, I what is going on there? It's crazy. And the behavior is just not. I mean, I understand it must be tough for her. She's the spouse and she has to, when you become a judge, your judge's spouses should effectively become restricted in what they can say and do. But that's, if you don't like that, then make a family decision to go back, go get a job at a law firm.
You want to talk like George Conway talks. You don't get to be a Supreme Court judge. Like, it is such an enormous
privilege.
And
if somebody appointed me to the bench tomorrow, I'd delete my Twitter account and I, bye.
You know, I firmly believe that it would be, I always wanted to be a judge. For the most part, I kept my mouth shut my whole life because of that. And then I decided, okay, I don't want to get appointed to a court by this. So I started just saying whatever the hell I want. And it's a great freedom to have when you reach a stage in life where you can say whatever you want, and everything you say in one form, you can say in another form with or without F-bombs, as I said. But that's something you give up when you become a judge. You accept that. You give up the money. You give up the freedom. And you have to can't look at things narcissistically. You can't look at it from your own personal predilections. You have to take a step back. You have to look at the law and you have to look at the facts, and you have to be as impartial and fair as you can be without you got to set a lot of stuff aside. It's hard to do. And the best judges are able to do it. And that doesn't mean there are not going to be disagreements, philosophical disagreements between some judges and others. We can read texts differently and look at past precedents differently. We can have different philosophies on how you go about resolving cases. But at the end of the day, you have to set your personal political predilections about the personalities involved in cases and the parties involved in cases or the movements they represent. And then you have to set aside to some extent what you think you want the law to be if it's not consistent with precedent and it's not something where you're willing to go out and say, I want to overrule this and I want to take the heat for it. You really have to, because it's not about you. It's not about any one individual. It's a job you're doing for the entire public, and it's a unique job, unlike being a representative where you're just trying to do what's popular in the moment. You have to set it, judging is a very, very different thing. And I don't want to be lecturing people who have been judges for so long, but it doesn't strike me as the way to go about things to be narcissistically feeling put upon and resentful and basically putting your own personal feelings and opinions and finances above the interests of the law and the court and the Constitution of the United States. So, I mean, if you can't do it, you shouldn't be on the bench.
Yeah, you know, the great irony of all of it is that they act in this partisan way because they're so mad that they think liberals, what, aren't patriotic or don't, you know, that you know, don't love the country or whatever. And instead, actually, what they're doing is tearing down this keystone institution. And you know what liberal democracy is? It's just a collection of institutions that need to function and people need to have faith in. And so for them to decry what they see as like the problems with liberals and whatever, so much so that they need to act like partisan political actors, they are doing great damage to the country. I think it reflects a tremendous lack of true patriotism to fly the flag upside down. Like, this is, I don't know, it is deeply disappointing. And
it's deeply disappointing.
They don't know how much damage they're doing.
I think all around we have to accept that there are, you know, we have to accept that our courts aren't perfect, but we have to demand a lot of individual judges at the same time.
Yeah.
We have to hold them to high standards. So, yeah, it's tricky. But
and this is where it'd be nice to see the conservative legal community stand up and try to act for some, like, demand better instead of defending.
Yeah, look,
I
think that what the way you have to look at these things, if you are okay, let's say you're, you know, you're Joe Schmo at the Federalist Society, or you're, you know, you're a conservative lawyer. Ask yourself what you would be saying if Elena Kagan had sped off in a $250,000 recreational vehicle that she didn't have to pay for and may not have reported and didn't, you know, to tax authorities. We don't know. All right. What would you say?
They would be beside themselves.
And they'd be right.
Yes.
They would absolutely be right. If Justice Sotomayor flew some kind of seditious left wing flag, like an Antifa flag, okay, or a flag that was not necessarily maybe a Revolutionary War flag that Antifa had adopted.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I mean, you know, you wouldn't go around say they wouldn't be going around saying, "Oh, well, it's an old flag. It means such and so. It doesn't really, just because Antifa uses the flag, no biggie deal." Yada yada. They wouldn't be saying that. They'd be going batshit, and they'd be right. And I that's the way. I mean, to me, that's the ultimate test that I try to apply to myself. I know I'm human. I'm not always consistent, but I was just like, okay. What if the people I like were doing the thing, or what if the people I don't like were, you know, try to put the shoe on the other foot. I can't justify this. And the reason why I can justify is I can't justify any justice behaving in either manner. Okay. And I just don't see how people don't understand the hypocrisy of the conservatives defending this conduct. They would be going bananas if these were the liberals. And they should, and they, as I said, they'd be right.
They'd be right. All right, George Conway,
okay.
As always, thank you for explaining the legal news to me and to our listeners. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave
us a
review.
Okay, now can I do this? Now can I shut you down?
Hold on. No, hold on. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, "Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell Longwell all about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Ebola mess to the Russian ties." Listen close.